It's 4:06. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me on Wednesday. Coming up, a meditation skeptic became a convert. He says meditation made his high-profile, high-energy life 10% happier. First, a new report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism raises concerns about guards abusing prisoners in the segregation unit at the state's oldest prison. Gilman Halstead reports.
The report documents 40 incidents of psychological or physical abuse allegedly committed by guards who patrol the segregation unit at the Waupun prison. Segregation is where inmates who violated prison rules end up. The allegations include inmates being beaten by guards while they are handcuffed behind their backs and wearing ankle shackles. Since 2011, inmates have filed 15 lawsuits against the guards, some of which are still pending. UW Law Professor Walter Dickey ran the prison system in the 1980s. He says the large number of complaints warrants further investigation.
You have to pursue complaints that facts demand that you pursue. Because I think ultimately if public confidence in our institutions and the rest of state government relies on confidence that they're doing things in an ethical and trustworthy and by the book manner.
The current DOC Secretary Ed Wall declined interviews about the guard abuse allegations, but the report quotes emails from DOC officials that say no guards have been disciplined for any of the incidents. The email says in almost all cases the allegations have been fabricated or exaggerated by inmates. Two-thirds of the inmate complaints involve one guard, Joseph Beam, who has worked for the past 9 years in the SEG unit at Waupun. Peg Swan, a former nurse who has visited or written to some of the inmates who have alleged abuse, says she's been trying for more than a year to convince prison authorities to address the problem.
I don't want this to be a lynching. It's not a whodunit. But this guy, every report has him in there, and I think the thugs have risen to the top. And my concern is that I can't have any evidence, but there's no way this happens without everybody turning away and records being manipulated.
Swan says part of the problem in her view is that there aren't cameras to record the incidents in some of the cells and hallways where the alleged abuse happened. This summer, the DOC is piloting a program at Waupun requiring guards to wear cameras on their chests to solve the problem. An email from the DOC says the guards themselves asked for the cameras to help them document what they called a high number of false accusations from inmates. Former DOC Secretary Walter Dickey says another approach is to make sure guards don't work too long in segregation units.
Segregation is tough duty, as tough as it comes in the prison. I personally wanted to rotate people through SEG, and I wanted to rotate them through so we always had some experienced people there, but that people never stayed too long. Because my experience was they tended to get jaded in that difficult environment.
The Guards Union resisted Dickey's efforts to do that when he tried it in the 80s. Inmate advocate Peg Swan says training for the guards at the basketball prison has led to fewer inmate abuse complaints there. Those changes were the result of a lawsuit brought by prisoners in the year 2000.
They've trained the guards there, and the guards are professional. Because of the lawsuit, the progressive end of the DOC is able to do more change. It gives them the climate where he can start putting funds into training guards.
DOC Secretary Ed Wall says plans are in the works to make comprehensive changes in the operation of segregation units in all the state's prisons, but so far he's released no details of what those changes will be. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Bill Leaders joins us now with a closer look at the allegations made against the guards at the Waupun Correctional Institution and that single guard named in many of the accusations. Bill's the reporter behind this week's three-part series by the WCIJ, which collaborates with Wisconsin Public Radio. A spokesperson for the Wisconsin Department of Corrections declined our invitation to join us today to comment on the allegations. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Well, earlier you joined Joy Cardine on the State Capitol Report to give an overview, and listeners, by the way, you can check that out at WPR.org/joy. This story today, though, looking at this one prison guard named in 28 of the 40 allegations you looked at, Gilman gave us a quick overview. Can you tell us a little more about that guard and the cases he's facing?
Well, I found more than 40 actual allegations, but I identified 40 for the purposes of this story, ones where there was a reasonable degree of specificity as to who was involved, when it happened, and I put together a chart of that. Of the 40 that I was able to find from various sources, including lawsuits that have been filed and complaints that have been filed and letters that have been written, Of the 40, 28 named the same guard, Joseph Beam, who has been with the Department of Corrections for about 9 years and has served almost exclusively in the segregation unit at Waupun. He's one of the officers who's doing what Walter Dickey says is something he wanted to avoid, is having the same officer work in segregation for a long period of time.
And what kinds of, what acts of staff and inmate abuse is he accused of?
Well, it runs the gamut. Much of it is really very severe. There are allegations of very severe beatings that have been administered by guards on inmates while they are handcuffed behind their back, being thrown down the stairs, being thrown into walls, being thrown into onto the floor, into cell doors. And when I obtained incident reports for many of these incidents, I was able to find that, yes, there was a use of force that was administered, that there was pepper spray or tasers, or inmates were directed into walls or directed into the floor, or knee kicks, knee strikes were delivered against them. In every case, it was explained that this was a necessary response to inmate resistance and misbehavior, and that guards only used the minimal amount of force that was necessary to control the situation. What the inmates say is that they're not resisting, they're just being beaten.
Are there prompting incidents, though, that are leading these responses? Do the inmates say or acknowledge that they did something that might have triggered some kind of response, whether this response went too far?
Sure. Sometimes that's very much true. In one of the cases that I covered in the article that ran today, the inmate actually admitted to throwing fecal matter at a guard. And then he said another guard appeared by his cell and said, Joseph Beam, he said, appeared by his cell and said, "We're going to kill you." There was another inmate who filed an affidavit saying that he heard this statement being made. And that supposedly occasioned about 30 minutes of torture, is how the inmate described it, that he was subjected to in the aftermath of this misbehavior.
What's the threshold for the prison or the Department of Corrections to investigate a prisoner complaint?
They have an internal complaint process, and an inmate can file a complaint alleging that he was mistreated. I have not seen one of those that led to any finding other than to be dismissed or rejected. There's a further appeal that inmates have, which is to file a lawsuit. And as I found, 15 separate lawsuits have been filed over the last 3 years against officers in the segregation unit at Waupun alleging excessive force or psychological abuse.
What kind of things did you hear from the Department of Corrections? Go and mention emails. What does the Department of Corrections say about these complaints and why none of these findings have gone against the guards?
They explain in their conduct reports that there was resistance and bad behavior and noncompliance on the part of the inmate, which was at the root of the use of force. So there's basically two sides to the story that are being told. The inmates say, we were beaten, we were abused, and the Department of Corrections is saying the inmate was misbehaving and we had to deal with the situation.
And does this guard continue, Beam, continue to work in the segregation unit?
So far as I know, yes.
What kind of changes in talking to people would people like to see to minimize the potential for abuse and to change the way they're investigated?
I spoke to Peg Swan, who was quoted in the report, and also State Senator Lena Taylor. Both of them felt that there needs to be a better complaint process for inmates, that it needs to be investigated by someone who is not directly involved with the institution. There needs to be some autonomy from the investigators, from the people that they're investigating. Peg Swan has also called for expanded mental health facilities. So did Kit Kirstensteiner of Disability Rights Wisconsin, who I quoted in my report. And there are calls for guards to be rotated out of segregation, which is what Dickey said he wanted, so that they're not working in that same environment for many months or years.
Is there any sign in your reporting or since the story has started coming out that any of those changes might be implemented?
Well, what I did find is, and this is the focus of part three, which runs tomorrow, is that Ed Wall, the Secretary of the Department of Corrections, has called for changes in how Wisconsin administers segregation. He wrote a memo in which he raised specific concerns about whether segregation was being used as a punitive punishment measure and whether that was counterproductive, whether it was making inmates more dangerous. He promised that there would be a review of how Wisconsin uses segregation. No details of that have been released.
Bill, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Bill Leaders, reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Tomorrow at this time, by the way, we'll get a closer look at the use of solitary confinement in the Wisconsin correction system with former state prison chief Walter Dickey. ABC News anchor Dan Harris has been on assignments that range from presidential elections to human trafficking. He's even had a run-in with wild elephants. But Harris says his most challenging assignment by far was much more personal, finding a way to tame the voice inside his head. Dan Harris joins today to tell the intimate story of his journey to not only tame that voice, but find greater happiness and peace of mind. His journey took him from the bright lights of TV studios to the fringes of self-help and the front line of neuroscience to come away with a simple way to calm his mind and be at least 10% happier every day. Dan Harris's new book is 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works. He shares what he's learned now. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Let's jump in with that voice in your head. The original title of your book, I can't say on the air, but it was, I'll paraphrase, my inner voice is a jerk. What was your inner voice and what kind of things was it telling you, that inner narrative?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a universal thing. We all have an inner narrator that is really the central feature of our lives. It is what we take to be us, the self. And most of us are so entranced by the nonstop conversation we're having with ourselves that we're unaware of this inner narrator, but it's the thing that has us constantly projecting into the future or remembering the past instead of being focused on whatever's happening right now. It's a sort of a jumble of urges and desires that has you reaching in the fridge when you're not hungry, or you know, checking your email when you're supposed to be talking to your kid. And having that pointed out to me was very powerful, and then finding a way to fix it was even more powerful.
We'll get into to fix it, but I want to lead you through how you got into trouble where you felt like you needed fixing. You were in a pretty high stress line of work, network journalism, not mellow like us here at Public Radio. And that inner voice was a driver. You saw it as a positive in some ways, even though it sometimes went in negative directions. Where was it steering you wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right that it can be positive. It can be what drives us. It can to drive us to succeed. It can drive us to be generous or funny or insightful. But it can also, if you're unaware of it, be a tricky puppeteer. In my case, I made a series of bad decisions that sort of began with my arrival here at ABC News when I was 28 years old. And I looked like I was barely post-pubescent, and I was working with these giants like Diane Sawyer and Peter Jennings and Ted Koppel, and I was green and aware of it and insecure about it. And so I made this decision to be a workaholic, and I threw myself into it. And after 9/11, I went to war zones across the Middle East and Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. And I kind of did so without really thinking about the psychological ramifications. And when I came home from that, after doing that for several years, I got depressed, crashed and burned a little bit, and then did another really dumb thing, which was I self-medicated for a brief period of time with recreational drugs. And even though I wasn't doing that when I was at work, definitely not when I was on the air, I later learned from my doctor that it raises the level of adrenaline in the brain, which is most likely what led to my having a panic attack on national television.
That's the nightmare for a person in journalism. You're on the air nationally and you have a panic attack.
Exactly. I mean, I was anchoring a Good Morning America, and I was halfway through a brief news update, and I just lost the ability to breathe. I couldn't breathe. My heart was racing. I just couldn't think straight anymore, and I had to bail right in the middle, and it was the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to me.
So now you're thinking, I got to help myself, but then there's this self-help movement. You felt, I'm going to understate it here, a bit skeptical about the self-help movement.
Yeah, I still think self-help is largely ridiculous. And the idea that you can solve all of your problems through the power of positive thinking is, I believe, demonstratively baloney. But I found myself gravitating towards some of the more interesting parts of self-help, like this guy Eckhart Tolle, who was the first person I'd ever heard talk about the voice in the head. And so there were some parts of self-help that I thought was interesting, but also a lot of it was really off-putting. And ultimately, after sort of marinating in this strange little American subculture for a while, I got turned on to the last thing I ever thought would be useful, which is meditation.
And what did you think of meditation before you gave it a shot?
As you can tell, I'm a pretty skeptical guy. I thought meditation was uniquely ridiculous for you know, hippies and gurus and people who live in a yurt or, you know, collect crystals or just not me, basically, you know, fans of Enya and John Tesh. And I was not going to go there. But then I heard about the science, and the science is incredible.
Bonus points for use of yurt there. What is it that got you making the first step and saying, OK, I'm going to swallow the skepticism for a little bit and actually try meditating?
It was when I was confronted with it, is a sheer volume of science that says that that meditation can do pretty incredible things for your brain and your body. You know, it's been shown to reduce your blood pressure, boost your immune system, and a whole range of positive effects on ailments, and both physical and psychological. But the real amazing stuff is the brain science, which a lot of which is being done in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
By Dr. Richie Davidson, who's a friend of mine, and it's been shown to thicken the gray matter, literally make your gray matter thicker in areas associated with self-awareness and compassion, and reduce the gray matter in an area associated with stress. And so this is why it's now being done by a whole elite subculture of very successful and impressive people, from the U.S. Marines to the U.S. Army to corporate executives to doctors, lawyers, school children, and even fidgety, skeptical news anchors.
Well, the only time I've ever meditated was with Richie Davidson sitting in the chair next to me teaching us how to meditate on the air. I had one of the same reservations that you expressed before you tried it, that you're not the kind of person, that I'm not the kind of person who could sit still and do nothing for a period of time.
But the thing is, first of all, sitting still is tricky still for me to this day, and I've been doing it for a long time. But you're not doing nothing, as a matter of fact. It's rigorous brain exercise, trying to wrestle the mind to the ground. It's like holding a live fish in your hands. It's really hard. But so is exercise. If you go to the gym and you're on the treadmill and you're doing it right, it's going to be difficult. That's the same thing with meditation. You got to think about it just like exercise for your brain. Every time, it's basically a focusing exercise. And every time you lose your focus and then return back to your point of focus, it's like doing a bicep curl for your brain. And you're breaking a lifetime of habit of walking around in a fog of memory or fantasy and actually focusing on what's happening right now. And it's beneficial in a whole bunch of ways.
Well, getting back to taming that voice in your head, that inner narrative we were talking about earlier, how did studying meditation, and I guess more to the point, practicing meditation, help you rein in that inner voice?
The first thing is the learning to focus when you're, to use a lack of a cliche, a less cliched term, when you're in the moment, when you're paying attention to what's happening right now, the inner narrator is in a lot less control. You're not casting off into some imagined future or remembering some idealized past. You're actually right here, right now. And so you're not getting yanked around as much. And so the ability, the muscle, building up the muscle to just pay attention is a huge way to defang the voice in the head. But really, the superpower that comes over time is the ability to see what's going on in your mind at any given moment, to notice anger, for example, without getting carried away by it. So let me just give you a quick example. You're online at Starbucks. Somebody cuts you off. You think to yourself, I'm angry. You then reflexively, immediately, and automatically inhabit the thought. You actually become angry. With mindfulness, with meditation, you actually learn to see the anger coming up in your head, or maybe the buzzing in your chest, your ears getting red, and you notice what's happening, but you don't actually have to take the bait and get carried away by it. That's amazing. I mean, think about how many times we lose our temper and regret it later. Think of any high-stress meetings we're in where it would have been nice to be the calmest person in the room. Think about how many times we eat when we're not actually hungry. If you can short-circuit this habitual behavior, it's a huge, huge advantage.
How long did it take to develop that? Was it overnight? You started meditating. All of a sudden, you had that meta ability to notice that you're angry and deal with it?
It took me a while, and I'm not perfect. I mean, there's a reason why I call the book 10% Happier. Mm-hmm. If we had my wife on the line right now, she could give you an hour-long interview on the ways in which I am imperfect. So I am not claiming that I became the Dalai Lama overnight. However, change did happen very quickly, and I would tell your listeners, give it 5 minutes a day for a couple of weeks, and if you don't find yourself feeling calmer, better at being present and focused on whatever's happening at any given moment, and a little bit more aware of what's actually happening in your skull, send me a note on Twitter and tell me I'm an idiot. But I don't think you'll be sending that note, because I actually think 5 minutes a day will make a significant difference.
Listening to a conversation we had with Dan Harris, co-anchor of ABC News' Nightline and author of the book 10% Happier. You can share your thoughts at the Central Time Facebook page. We continue the conversation we had with Dan Harris, co-anchor of ABC News Nightline and co-anchor for the Met Weekend edition of Good Morning America. His book is called 10% Happier. He says happiness can come from meditation, actually. It's about how he dealt with stress and a panic attack on the air. By turning to meditation, he says he found himself, give or take, 10% happier. Dan, I want to talk about the 10% thing. As you mentioned earlier, you were and still are skeptical of self-help because of a lot of over-promising. Why is that the case? Why is there so much of that out there?
It sells books, and people like the idea of a miracle cure. It's attractive. But I think we're ready in America for a more realistic discussion. I think people have been burned enough times being sold a bill of goods that they can fix everything in their life in one fell swoop. And for me, the answer, 10% happier, that I started saying that when my skeptical friends would ask me, why are you meditating? What's happened to you? And I found myself saying, oh, you know, because it makes me 10% happier. And I would notice when I said that, that the looks of scorn on the faces of my friends would transform into something more like interest and envy, because, you know, 10% is a pretty good return on investment, and it sounds reasonable. So I just named the book that.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Guy on the line in West Allis. Guy, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering, when do you find is the best time to meditate? Because I know right now I'm potentially going through a job layoff, and it's like I'm stressed a lot of the time, and it's like, you know, do I do it right away in the morning? Would that help all day, or do I have to try to find time at work where I can get away from everybody and do it there, but then you're supposed to be at work, and it's like, when's the best time to do it?
First of all, thanks for the question. I appreciate it. I don't think you have to be overly neurotic or militant about it. I think you should do it whenever's best for you. Personally, my schedule is crazy, so I just fit it in when I can. You don't want to make it something that's just another stressor in your life. It should be fit in a time when you can, but every day is different. And so I try to do 30 minutes a day. That's just because I find it really beneficial. But there are days when things are super crazy, like they were yesterday, for example, and I only did 10. So give yourself a break, but there's something about the dailiness of it that can make a huge difference, because it's that daily confrontation with the craziness of your own mind that allows you, when your mind is being crazy in real life, to recognize, oh, I don't have to take this so seriously.
But don't stress out because you can't find that full half hour to fit in.
Correct.
Okay.
And by the way, I do a half hour, but I'm writing a book about this. So, I mean, I'm not necessarily saying everybody needs to do a half hour. I believe that 5 minutes is enough, especially for a starter.
Guy, thanks for the question, and good luck with your job situation.
Yeah.
We'll go now to Kurt in Evansville. Kurt, hi.
Hi. I'm listening to this, and I'm wondering, is there much of a difference between prayer and meditation? And if there is, what would that difference be?
You know, it depends on the prayer, and it depends on the meditation, and from a neurological standpoint. So there have been studies that look at what prayer does to the brain, as well as all these studies about what meditation does to the brain. And I'm not an expert on the prayer piece of this, but I believe there's some commonalities. And I have some evangelical friends who, for example, a pastor friend of mine who does this practice where he walks around and tries to see the world through Jesus's eyes, and so in a much more compassionate way, and it, just in his view of passersby on the street. That's not entirely dissimilar to a type of meditation known as compassion meditation. What I think is radical about both of these is that you're actually training your brain to be more empathetic and more compassionate. It shows up on the brain scans when you do compassion meditation. What a radical notion that we aren't stuck with our perceived level of compassion from birth. It's actually a muscle we can train. Think about if we start teaching kids how to do this, what that would do for bullying, or never mind the future of the planet. So and meditation is the same thing. It basically is saying you're not stuck with your level of happiness just based on the quality of your childhood or your employment situation or whether you've won the lottery recently. It's a skill that can be trained. To me, that is such a radical and interesting notion.
And not just happiness. I think you make the point in there that we don't have to take any of our basic personality traits or maybe flaws for granted.
It's all part of a story we tell ourselves. We are this kind of person. I'm a shy person, or I'm a loner, I'm irritable, et cetera, as if these are fixed things that can never, ever be changed. But I think they can be changed. I'm not talking about some radical overnight transformation into a golden retriever. I'm just saying that around the edges, you can recognize that this is a story you're telling yourself that in any given moment isn't necessarily true. And with meditation, you can get much better at not taking these habitual, lifelong, and often debilitating stories so seriously.
Back to our callers now with Dawn in Waukesha. Dawn, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think about this?
Well, my question is, I was telling the person who answered the phone, type AAA you're talking to right now, going from 5 in the morning till 10 or 11 at night. How do you slow down? How do you actually meditate? I mean, I'm an educated person, but how do you meditate? What do you mean when you say meditate? You sit there on a pillow? What do you do?
You want me to give you a quick 30-second lesson?
101. Go for it, Dan. Yeah.
All right, let's do this. The other day, for a New York Times technology reporter, I gave him a meditation lesson in fewer characters than it takes to send a tweet. But I'm going to give you a slightly longer version, Don. With the caveat that the word meditation is kind of like the word sports. It can describe a whole range of activities, but I'm talking about a meditation called mindfulness, which is completely secular, nothing to join, no fees to pay, nothing to believe or anything like that. It's just a form of exercise for your brain. So here's what it involves. Sit down. You can actually do it standing up or lying down, but traditionally you just sit down. You don't have to be cross-legged. You can be in a chair. It's important to have your spine straight just because you don't want to fall asleep if you're too slouched. Close your eyes and then pick a spot where you feel your breath most prominently, like your nose, your chest, your belly. And you don't have to breathe in any special way. Just notice what it feels like when the breath comes in and when the breath goes out. There's nothing special about the breath. It's just a good thing to focus on because we're always breathing as long as we're alive. And then every time your mind wanders, which it will a million times, whether you're AAA personality or not, your mind is going to wander to crazy things like, what did I have for lunch? Why did I say that stupid thing to my boss, et cetera, et cetera. Every time your mind wanders, just forgive yourself and bring your attention back to your breath. And it's rigorous. It's a rigorous brain exercise. It's very tough to do. But every time you catch yourself, that's a bicep curl for your brain. You are breaking a lifetime of habit of just being lost in this thought that defines our life. Instead, you're just focusing on what's happening right now, which in this case is your breath.
Don, give it a shot and good luck. Dan, one thing you were worried about is maybe if you solve some of the problems with the voice in your head, you might lose your edge and you're in an industry where maybe it's taken for granted. You're going to be hot-tempered, high stress, and that's just part of the gig.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a widespread cultural assumption that in order to be successful, you have to be somewhat miserable. In order to be Van Gogh, you need to cut your ear off. But I'm not sure that's true. In fact, I found that the less the not being a hostage to the noise in my brain, the noise that we all have going on in our mind at any given moment, has made me a better, more efficient, effective decision maker, a better colleague, a better listener, more efficient at doing the work I need to do at any given moment. And this is why you're seeing such spectacularly successful people like the co-founder of Twitter, Phil Jackson, the basketball coach, the U.S. Marines, the U.S. Army, rock stars, et cetera, now adopting this practice, because it is you can see the decreased mental noise and the increased efficiency.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, it's a total pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was a conversation we had with Dan Harris, co-anchor of ABC News' Nightline and co-anchor for the weekend edition of Good Morning America. He's author of the book 10% Happier. Frank Kovac loved to take groups outdoors to lead astronomy tours of the Northwood skies, but he hated to have those tours thwarted by clouds. So Frank says he took the next logical step. He built his own planetarium. Frank now gives tours to more than 3,000 people a year.
I grew up in Chicago. I could not see the sky real well from the city because of all the lights, so trips to Wisconsin is where I was able to start seeing the sky and enjoy it. It was around the age of 12 my dad had a telescope that he showed me the moon through, and that's where my interest peaked when I started learning about astronomy. From about the age of 12, I would find any book I could from there on and read about astronomy or space. I was able to find a job in Rhinelander at a paper company. I would like sharing my view of the sky with scout groups or just families. After I had a scout group presentation at a local town hall, we were going to come out and look at the stars through the telescope. It clouded over, and I thought, that's it. I'm going to build a planetarium. You tell that to people, they think you're crazy. Well, I started drawing pictures on scratch paper. There were no blueprints. There was no book telling me what to do here. I had an idea of a star map. I did it over 10 to 12 years with whatever I had left over from my local paper mill job. And I used that money to buy material. And by doing it over time, I could afford it. The globe is built chiefly out of plywood, 3/4 inch and 1/2 inch thick plywood. I was able to put the stars in there with the best glow in a dark paint I could find. I had many times where I wanted to quit because I had times where something would not work. I opened the planetarium in the year 2007, the month of June. The planetarium is powered by a 1/2-horsepower gear motor. If the planetarium did not rotate, the only thing people would see would be the stars that are currently visible, which might be the springtime sky. I have approximately 3,000 people per year coming through here. When people arrive, I explain to them what this thing is. Welcome to the Kovac Planetarium. My name is... They explain where the planets are. They learn about how big the planets, stars, and the moon and sun are compared to Earth. And, of course, where we live in the galaxy. So the show consists of basics of astronomy, and that is what people enjoy. The planetarium is dedicated in my dad's memory for his sharing the sky with me. I sometimes can't believe this thing works. I am totally amazed at not just the globe itself, but the beauty of the stars inside. It looks so realistic. It's unbelievable.
You can see Frank's Planetarium in action tonight at 8 on Wisconsin Public Television. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. For more info, visit wisconsinlife.org or look for Wisconsin Life on Facebook. Now, we check out a program here in the state that since 1996 has been trying to bring Wisconsinites just a little bit closer to the objects in the sky. It's called Universe in the Park, and it could be coming to a state park near you. Eric Wilcotts is here with us in the studio. He's a professor of astronomy and associate dean for the natural and mathematical sciences at UW-Madison. He's program director for Universe in the Park. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So what is Universe in the Park?
Well, it's a pretty simple idea, just as we heard in that last piece. And the idea is that the best way to introduce folks to the night sky is outside, where the skies are dark, far away from city lights. And so we picked the state parks. We go out to state parks around Wisconsin all during the camping season from May to October, show people what's up in the sky. We have a telescope that we take out there and we do a little presentation.
And what is it about the state parks that makes them a great place to watch the stars?
Well, for the reasons people go out there is to enjoy the outdoors. And most of the parks are far away from city lights. Some of the darkest places in the state are at state parks. Newport, for example, up on Door County. So the skies are generally dark. We can see lots of things, and the parks already have naturalist programs, so folks go there anticipating some sort of program, and we like to provide that service.
In that piece, we heard Frank talk about his dad sharing the sky with him and him kind of paying it forward. What's it like to share the sky with people?
It's absolutely fantastic, and some of the best parts are kids who come up with some just fantastic questions. You look at these seven-year-olds and you wonder, where did they learn that? But it's adults who are trying to remember maybe the things that their parents taught them about the sky years ago, and they know vaguely what that star, that constellation is, and just being able to give them that information, it's a lot of fun. You see a lot of excitement, enthusiasm, the people just get into it.
What kind of things do we learn if we go to Universe in the Park?
Some of the things we heard on the last piece, what planets are up, how to identify the planets, how to find your way around the night sky, what are the constellations, one of the great things we like to do is how to find Arcturus. You look for the arc from the Big Dipper, follow the arc to Arcturus. So it's little things like that so folks can then enjoy the night sky on their own afterwards.
And how do people react when they get this great view? And, you know, maybe they're coming from a bright lights, biggish city where you can only see, you know, what, a percent of the stars you could see out in the dark.
Yeah, we get a lot of wows. We get a lot of, I didn't know that that's really what Saturn looked like through a telescope. And looking at Saturn through a telescope is fantastic. The best thing is probably the full moon or close to a full moon. It's really bright. And then you can see the detail on the moon. You can see the landscape. And people just have not seen the moon in that way.
When I'm out stargazing without telescope, I kind of always view the full moon as a curse because it's, you know, shining out all the stars.
Yep, it does do that. But when you're looking through a telescope, it's actually a fantastic sight.
Okay. So where can we find a schedule, I should ask before I forget? How do we know when you're coming to a park?
We have one on the Department of Astronomy website, so www.astro.wisc.edu, and there'll be links to outreach. Just click on that, and you should see the schedule for Universe in the Park. We try to get as many state parks as we can during the summer.
I looked at the list. You really are hitting a lot of places through the summer.
We're busy. We'll be as far north as Big Bay State Park later on in August and as nearby to Madison as Blue Mound State Park on, I think, August 2nd.
You've got a bunch coming up this weekend. What are we going to see in the night sky if we check out one of the programs?
We should see Saturn still. It's still up looking good. We should see Mars. And then if it's really dark, there's something called the Ring Nebula, which is the remains of a star like the Sun that died a couple billion years ago. But you can see that faint glow from that star. And if it's really, really dark, we might be able to see a galaxy or two.
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite things, and it's rare that I'm in a place where I can see it, is actually seeing the Milky Way, the band of it. Can we see that from our state parks?
We can, absolutely. In this time of the year, it becomes very prominent. So if it's a really good dark night, you'll see that faint band across the sky. And I should say one of the best things coming up is the Perseid meteor shower in August. You don't need a telescope, but getting out to a state park where you've got a good view of the night sky away from city lights, it's fantastic. We'll probably have 200-300 people up at Newport for that event.
One of my favorite things is being up on the shores of Lake Superior in hopefully a dark place and watching the Perseids. Last year, there was a full moon while I was up there. That's why I was cursing the moon.
We should get a little luckier this year.
Well, let's talk about the telescope. Is this something that we might buy if we're a backyard hobbyist, or do you have kind of a souped-up, fancier one?
The amazing thing is we go to some state parks and some of the amateurs show up with better telescopes than we have. So ours are our standard Celestron 8 to 10 inch in diameter. They're fully automatic. They can track. They can point. They're GPS. So one of the difficulties with pointing a telescope is you have to tell the telescope where it is. Mm-hmm. It helps to have a GPS on there so it knows that on its own. So these are not super fancy telescopes. They're several hundred dollars, but many amateurs have better ones than we do.
What does Saturn, you mentioned Saturn being up now, what does it look like through the telescope you're using? How much detail do
you
get?
You get to see the rings and in a little bit of detail, but it looks like what you think it should look like, which is sort of surprising to people.
And you mentioned galaxies. What do our neighboring galaxies look like through this telescope, if we're lucky?
It takes a little imagination. So M31, the Andromeda Galaxy, looks like a faint oval. And if you just sort of let your mind run with it a little bit and realize that it's something the size of the Milky Way with 100 billion stars in it that you're being able to see through a little telescope.
How weather dependent are you at these events?
We will go on if it's cloudy. We'll give a presentation. Mm-hmm. If it's pouring down rain and there's no indoor space, we won't have it. But we have, remember, several years ago, we kept going during our tornado warning up at Devil's Lake. The people were there. We kept talking.
I don't know if I can...
yeah, we won't sanction that.
Okay. hey, one thing that I'd love to see someday, and I still haven't, knock on wood, I will someday, the Northern Lights. I don't know if a weather person, you can predict this sort of thing, or is it just going to show up when it wants to show up?
It shows up when the sun is active, so you will get 2-3 days notice. So if there's a flare from the sun, and it's coming at the right direction at the right time, we're able to predict when there is a likelihood of the Northern Lights, but there's no guarantees. Your best bet is to go as far north as possible.
Okay. All right. What do you have a favorite time of year to be out stargazing, or is it all good because it's always changing?
I like it all. It's all good, but I love September and October. The humidity's down. Mm-hmm. The sky's a little clearer. The mosquitoes are gone. And some of those fall evenings are absolutely spectacular.
Now, over the last 5-10 years, we've been getting some amazing satellite telescope images from around the galaxy. We don't have to go out and stargaze for those. They're fancier, and we can see through our atmosphere. Any favorite things that you've seen in that kind of imaging?
Well, the images from Hubble, or the Hubble Space Telescope, are absolutely spectacular. My own personal preference is some of the images we have from our solar telescopes that show just how active the sun is are mind-boggling.
What's going on the sun's surface? So what are we just now learning about?
It's actually been fairly quiet for the solar cycle, which is a bit unusual, but it is always doing something interesting with its magnetic fields, with flares, with prominences. So there's some time-lapse images. You can see real live movies of the sun sort of spitting off blobs of material into space.
And there are things we're learning that we just didn't know about
sun
before.
Absolutely. How active it is, how variable it is, and its interaction with our own magnetic sphere.
Eric, very interesting, and I hope we can have you back on to talk astronomy
my pleasure.
In the future.
Anytime.
That's Eric Wilcotts. He's the program director for Universe in the Park and a professor of astronomy at UW-Madison. And can we get a Central Time Facebook page link? I'm going to turn away from the mic. Yes, there was a nod. We'll put up a link to info about Universe in the Park over at the Central Time Facebook page.